I'm here with Ricky Ponting on what should have been the final day of the Vodafone Ashes series. It wrapped up 2 days ago. Ricky, let's start with who your player of the series might have been. Travis Head got the honour on Sunday night. Would you have gone with him or would you have picked someone else?
No, I think, yeah, I would have gone with Travis, actually. And I know he missed that one test match, and but played brilliantly around that, really. When you think back to Brisbane, the first test up there, pretty challenging conditions as well in that test match. And the reason I'm going to go with Travis is just because of how challenging the conditions were for batsmen. You know, we've seen, you look at the numbers, all the Australian bowlers were able to dominate, weren't they? Pretty much every single one of the bowlers had a really good series, which suggested the wickets were tough to bat on. But, those 200s that Travis made, and even, I mean, Brisbane was quite remarkable the way that he played up there to bring up his 100 off 85 balls. But even in Hobart, when, you know, things were pretty tough on that first day, you know, Australia 3 for 12, but he had the conviction to come out and play his natural game and did it really, really well. I mean, I think England look back and understand that they probably missed a trick for potentially most of the series with the way that they bowled to him after what we saw in the second innings in Hobart. But I think he was quite clearly the man of the series, in my opinion. I wouldn't have given him man of the match in Hobart. I would have gone the other way in Hobart. I would have had Green as man of the match down there, but still Head as the man of the series.
Yeah, I think that's quite fair, given Green had done well with bat and ball.
Yeah.
I could ask you about England for about, you know, half an hour, mate, but we've talked about them a lot in this series. The one question I do have for you that I didn't ask you while the series was going on, would you let England players play in the Sheffield Shield as it looks like their CEO might have requested?
No, I wouldn't. I think the suggestion was to let some of their young up-and-coming players come and play in the Sheffield Shield, and I don't see the benefit in that to Australian cricket whatsoever. I mean, I think the fact that overseas players have been able to go to county cricket is because they've all been better players than what the county players are. They're all, and they're bringing experience and, you know, knowledge and everything to the counties and helping their younger players out. But I don't think it would, and that's why that's obviously why the counties chase the overseas players. One, to strengthen their teams, and two, to for the younger players to learn from. And it'd be the exact opposite of that. You know, you'd have to question if, you know, some of the younger England players that came out here, if they'd actually be good enough to even play in the Sheffield Shield competition. It's not as simple as county cricket either. With all the teams there, they're actually looking for players. We've got nowhere near as many teams here. And, we're quite often there's guys that probably should be playing Shield cricket that can't get an opportunity. So I don't see the benefit in it for Australian cricket whatsoever. I mean, they're probably better off. To be honest, they come and play grade cricket for sure, because I think, grade cricket's probably as strong as what some county cricket is anyway. And if it's not, they're still playing in Australian conditions with the Kookaburra ball, all the things that they want to be able to do. I think they can probably do in probably the stronger grade setups in Australia, whether it's in Sydney or Melbourne grade cricket. I know you wind the clock back 20, 30, 40 years ago, there were always a lot of English players coming and playing, particularly in Perth. You know, Alex Stewart and guys like that played summer after summer of grade cricket in WA. So, and even thinking about that, if it's about conditions and learning about faster, bouncier pitches, maybe that's the place for them to go as well. Because, you know, there or Queensland, where grade crickets are probably a lot different than what they play on in the UK, I still think they've got an opportunity to learn about Australia and Australian conditions without actually playing Sheffield Shield cricket.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here, Ricky. If you think about the last three Ashes series, England haven't won a test. Clearly, something is off. If you think also about the Ashes series being quite important to Australian cricket, we want it to be competitive, obviously, although I imagine everyone kind of wants Australia to win. Do you think there might be, you know, that's potentially a reason if we want to keep the rivalry alive?
Look, once again, I think it just comes back to the quality of the player that they would want to, get into the Shield system. If it's some of their better, you know, if it's a Pope or a Billings, those sort of guys that you can see that have got international quality games, then and and they're not keeping potentially a future Australian player out of the Shield team, then fine. But I mean, I think, you know, they've got to be looking at getting their own backyard right first over there. I mean, I've just read some of the comments that Joe Root had to say at the end of this series, talking about how, you know, if guys have come into the team, you know, it's not been on the back of county cricket helping them get there. It's almost been the other way. You know, county cricket is actually holding a lot of their players back, is what he believes. So I think that's the obvious thing. They've got to sort that out first. You know, Bumble, I thought, made a really good point on one of the tea chats we had with him about just how early in the year they're now playing county cricket. They're almost playing it like in the winter months with, you know, underprepared wickets and the ball seeming around all over the place. You know, some of Joe's comments this morning, I think, were, you know, why would anyone want to open the batting in county cricket? Why does anyone want to bat at the top? You know, that there's no incentive for that. There's no incentive for anyone to run and be a fast bowler anymore in county cricket, because you've only got to run in and bowl sort of slow, medium pace and stand the seam up and you're unplayable. So there's a few things there, I think, that they have to try and work out. And we've battled that as well through the, you know, with the Big Bash being the time of year that it is, and getting the right amount of Shield games in the guys before the test matches start. And then, you know, how do you keep guys in form through the test summer when there's only Big Bash cricket on? So there's all these challenges that we've had as well. But I would think about letting some of these guys play in our Shield competition if they are better than what we've got. But if they're not better, then I don't see the benefit in it.
Let's think about Australia now. Pat Cummins has made it very clear that winning away is now the team's biggest challenge. Obviously, they've got Pakistan and Sri Lanka to go to this year for the test team, and then India and England potentially in 2023. Should all Australia's planning, particularly around test cricket, be geared towards India and England next year?
I don't think all of it. I think they'll keep one eye on that. But I think, you know, on the back of what they've just done and obviously things heading in the right direction, I think they've just got to be, you know, stay in the present as much as possible and a thing that they would like to be able to do now is just keep this group as close together as possible, you know, not potentially have too many changes around their group. You know, I think we used 14 or 15 players in this series. That was on the back of a couple of injuries and obviously with Marcus Harris's sort of not grabbing his opportunity. But you would like to think for the next couple of years now with what we've seen that there probably won't be many changes in the group. And I think that'll be a target or a plan for them. So Pakistan, Sri Lanka, they'll be challenging. You know, that won't be easy. Pakistan are a good team that will play their conditions really well. You know, we've had issues in Sri Lanka in the past, although the depth of their cricket right now is probably not as good or as strong as it, you know, it sort of once was. But I don't think all of their planning just should be around India and England.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I've worded you up on this one, Ricky. In terms of, I'd like you to give me three players who didn't play in these Ashes series or in this Ashes series for Australia who might be important for I guess, the next couple of years in Test cricket.
Yeah, well, even the next couple of series, really. I mean, the first one, Mitch Swepson is one that with 10 test matches coming up in the subcontinent, you'd think that there'll be times where they'll potentially want to play the two spinners. You know, Swepo's been around the setup for the last couple of summers. He's improved greatly, listening to James Hopes and guys that have worked with him pretty closely at Queensland. You know, his last Shield season was really good. Even his record bowling at the Gabba the last few years is good as well. So and there was some noise about him potentially playing in Sydney as well, wasn't there? So I think he's the obvious one that we didn't see in this series, especially with what's coming up. Pekoski's probably the other one as well that we just hope that he's going to be able to get back to full health and fitness. And, you know, he's back playing grade cricket now, which is a good sign. You know, and I think at the moment that he does get a bit of cricket under his belt, I think they'll get him straight back into the squad and have him around. You know, obviously he was the first choice opener, you know, this time 12 months ago and just played that one test and hurt himself. And then a few of the other concussion things have come back again. But I think, you know, what we saw in that first test that he played against India, he looked very much at home. Technically, he stood up. And he's been, you know, talked about for the last 3 or 4 years as someone that's potentially, better than most, better than probably every other young player that we've got in Australia. So it'd be good to see him back and around the group again. The third one gets a bit tougher. The bowling stocks, I think, the depth we've got in the bowling stocks, we've seen with Boland and Nisa and Jai and those guys having played. I think there's still potential somewhere for someone like a Riley Meredith to sort of probably add his name in amongst that sort of top group of fast bowlers as well, just with what he's got being a bit different than most. That real dynamic high 140s to 150 sort of pace that we've seen in Big Bash cricket. And so I think there might be an opportunity for him, in the next couple of years, looking to the next Ashes tour, if they're looking for a bit more pace to be, be added to that group. I think there's a chance for someone like him. There's not many. I mean, as far as a backup keeper, I guess, if they go on tours, they might think about taking a couple of keepers. And I think Josh Inglis is the one, although he hasn't had a great Big Bash, I still think he'll be the next cab off the rank as far as keeper batters are concerned, that'll play Test cricket or be talked about of playing Test cricket. And that's not because I think Carey won't be around for the next couple of years. But if you're looking at a backup or if there's an injury to Carey, then I think he's probably the obvious one that we haven't seen yet that would probably be added to a touring group. So they're probably the three or four that I've just thrown at you there that would be a chance, I reckon, in the next 2 years.
Yep, you've given me a bonus player. Very good. Ricky, is Justin Langer the right man to lead Australia beyond this series?
I can't see how he's not, mate. I know there was a bit of noise created the last couple of weeks and Cricket Australia giving no assurances to him continuing on. It sounds like there's a bit of uncertainty around what they're going to do with the head coach's role anyway, if they're going to split the roles, if they're just going to keep it as the one person across all formats. I don't know how far or they are down the line with planning that or thinking about doing that, or if they've actually made a decision that they are going to split the roles. So, look, I can't see how Justin can't go on. And the way that I would equate it as well is if Justin is not to be offered another deal on the back of the best coaching year of his life, then, if you equate that to a player, that's like Travis Head not getting offered a contract next year. So I just can't see how it's possible. I think the other thing that they have to probably keep in the back of their minds, as whether it's the players, whether it's Cricket Australia, is that, sometimes the grass is not always greener either. And what they've been able to do has been pretty remarkable these last 4 or 5 months. Justin's been asked to change a lot of things about, about the way that he coached. He's been able to do that, obviously. Well, I think we've all seen that, how much of a back seat he's sort of taken the last few months compared to beforehand. And, he's got the assistants more heavily involved and helping out more, which is, one of the things that apparently needed to change around the group. So he's done everything that's been asked of him and the results have followed. So I just can't see how if he wants to continue on, I just can't see how he doesn't get another 2 or 3 year extension on his, or well, not extension, but just another 2 or 3 year contract.
Have you spoken to him, Ricky? Is he keen to keep going?
I haven't asked him that question specifically, but I just know he loves the job. He loves being the coach of the Australian cricket team. He's a very competitive person, and he's had some pretty lofty goals and things he's wanted to achieve, especially with the World Cup just happened and then the Ashes. Then we've got another T20 World Cup coming up in under 12 months' time. So, I haven't actually sat down with him and just said out now, do you want to keep doing this? But I've got the feeling that it's just in his blood. He'd want to keep doing it, especially now that he's changed himself and the success has followed. So I can't say why he wouldn't want to keep doing it.
How much input should players have in, there's obviously going to be some kind of process in terms of reviewing whether it's splitting the roles or whatever it needs to be. How much input should the playing group have in that?
Playing group, I think, is a bit broad. I think a couple of senior players would be enough, I would imagine. I don't see why, a fringe player or someone that's been in the test side or whatever, I don't understand why they'd even be asking a lot of the players, to be honest. Pat, fine. Finchie, fine. He was the captain of the teams, respectively. Maybe a couple of the more of the senior guys, but that's all. I don't think it needs to go any further than that.
And you touched on, I guess, the splitting the roles, and that's something that's been talked about, you know, even as towards the end of Darren Lehman's tenure as coach. I mean, how much of an appetite? We know Justin's got a huge appetite for kind of coaching, and he has enjoyed doing all three formats. But is that, if he does kind of continue on, is it potentially one where he might just take the test team or might just take the one day and T20 team, like given how much COVID has impacted things and how many series they might have to kind of make up, do they really need to kind of look at that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt it's been a challenging couple of years for anyone that's played international sport. Cricket's probably been as affected as any. And it's, you know, the COVID things and the bubble, the lifestyle they've had to live and lead. And I know even with Justin now, I mean, I don't think he's seen his family since the start of the summer, and even to now, I don't think he can actually get back into WA now, even if he wanted to, I don't think, until about the 5th of February. So there's no doubt it's been hard for him and been challenging for him. As far as, if they did split the roles, I don't know what he would want to do. I mean, and even splitting the roles, it sounds easy and it sounds like a great idea, but I just think that there's could be some other issues and problems that come with that as well. If you've got a white ball coach that is one sort of person, one sort of personality, then you switch over the next week to someone that's completely different with the way that they look at the game and view people and players. I mean, I think one thing you would want as a player, you'd want continuity, I would imagine. I mean, that's what I would have wanted when I was playing. I would have, you know, I wanted a coach that understood me as a person and understood my technique and what I was doing when I was batting well and what I was doing when I wasn't batting well. That's sort of all I wanted from a coach. And if you've got, you know, two different sets of eyes looking at that and critiquing it through the course of, you know, even from week to week, then that could pose and present its own set of challenges as well, I think, for a cricket team. So I mean, I think, you know, if there's someone there that can do it, you know, and is willing to give up as much time as it takes to fulfil that head coach's role with the Australian cricket team, then I would 100% just leave it at the one person. But if it's getting too hard and too challenging and it's wearing the coaches down to a point where they can't function as well as they need to, then that would be the only time that I'd think about splitting the roles.
And if that did happen around the T20 team, Ricky, is it something you'd be interested in doing?
I'd be interested. I'd have to have a look at how it sort of fit in with everything else that I'm sort of doing though, with IPL and even just with the Channel 7 stuff in the summer. You know, obviously with 7, we don't do the international games anyway, so there might be a chance that it could work, and I'd definitely entertain the idea. I mean, I've been on record since I finished, really, when I've been asked about coaching around the Australian team. It's always been a time commitment that I'm not sort of willing to give up, but if it was a specific T20 role only, which even with that would probably mean then that you've got three separate coaches, which is, you know, I don't think that wouldn't be ideal. If you've got a T20 coach, a one day coach and a test coach, I don't think that would be ideal. And the fact that then if it was white ball only, that potentially takes up a bit more time than I'd be willing to give up as well. I'd have a look at it. I'd, if they wanted to put something in front of me, and I'd definitely have a look at it all. Yeah.
It's one to keep an eye on for sure, Ricky. We've really enjoyed having your insights on for the summer, mate, and look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Yeah, it's been great fun, mate. Thanks, Louis.
Well, Louis, that was Ricky Ponting, and you were lucky enough to speak to the great man after every day's play of the Ashes series. Tell us, did you feel like you got some nuggets out of the great man?
Yeah. Hopefully. I mean, I've had a lot of good feedback about you know, people listening to the podcast and listening to Ricky, if not me. They probably got sick of me talking a little bit, but yeah, it was really good. He's a good cricket brain, isn't he?
Yeah, he's brilliant, isn't he? Not sure we got quite as many commentary wicket predictions as last summer on Channel 7, but his insights are always great.
100%. He was pretty amazing last year with some of the ones on Channel 7. He's pretty damn sharp.
So we saw the first ever Ashes test in Hobart, and you were there, Lou. Tell us about the experience of being at the ground and what it was like, and should we see Ashes cricket in Hobart again?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably only ever going to be a fallback option, really. I mean, the only reason they got this one was because Perth you know, just are in a point of a pandemic where they're basically operating as a different country. So you would think that next time England come back, I mean, you know, speaking of predictions, it's pretty hard to know what the world's going to look like in 4 years, but you'd think you'd probably go back to the main five cities, and Perth is one of them. Perth, you know, probably the poor people there probably could do with a test match. But yeah, I think we know now that Hobart can do it. And it was a great venue. It was really fantastic just how it operated. I thought it was a really great pitch, probably tilted slightly in the favour of the bowlers. But, you know, I think the way England batted probably made it seem worse than it really was. So definitely a fallback option, I think. But, you know, just pure geography or population-wise would say that Perth probably will take when England come back in 4 years' time.
You've been to a lot of the venues around Australia. So where does Hobart rank for you as far as test cricket venues go?
Yeah, right up there. I mean, Perth Stadium is really incredible. Like, they've just done such a great job in how they've set that up, and the technology around it is it's kind of like a futuristic MCG almost, and slightly smaller. And Perth people really turn out for all the games of cricket I've done there. I did the ODI in 2018, I think it was, between Australia and England, which is fantastic, and you know, the BBL games are really well attended. So, but Hobart's great. I mean, I'm not sure about the day-night thing and whether they'd do that again. Like, I think that the day-night one was, you know, was really done because broadcasters had penciled in a later time slot. So 3 p.m. starts were really late, and you try not to, as a, you know, journo covering it, you try not to let that influence you too much, because, you know, obviously our life is different when we're writing things and publishing podcasts and all that kind of thing at 11 p.m. at night. We've got to think about what the fan wants. And personally, you know, people I speak to seem to think that that they are just as happy with a day test as a day night. And I think the players like that too. They kind of accept Adelaide and, you know, like that as the being one on the schedule. But yeah, I think, you know, personally, I'd love to see it go back to that one being a day test, and then Adelaide's a really good day-night option, I think, too.
Yeah, if we look ahead to the future tours program, we've got South Africa and the West Indies in Australia next summer for test matches. I think that might be 3 and 2, so 5 tests for the summer. Does that mean that Hobart misses out again? And would they be unlucky if that's the case?
Yeah, I guess it probably would, but you just never know. Like, you wouldn't have predicted Hobart was going to get the test this summer, and they kind of had to turn to him at the last minute. You also got Canberra, who did a good job of hosting Sri Lanka a couple of years ago. So you probably know you got 7 really, you know, top test venues. So yeah, I'd love to see test cricket go back to Hobart for sure.
So maybe it's worth revisiting our pre-Ashes series predictions as well, because we made a few on this podcast, and I'm not sure too many have come off, but you did make a serious prediction, scoreline 2-1, I think you said, with 2 draws. do you want to talk us through how that one panned out?
I'm trying to remember where I said the draws would be, and if one of them was in Perth, then, you know, maybe I could be excused for that, you know, embarrassing prediction. I mean, yeah, I mean, maybe I overestimated how good England might be, but they were awful. Yeah, there's no two ways of putting it. So I'm going to pin that on them and not my own my own stupidity. And then it probably wasn't as wet as we, you know, everyone was talking about La Nina and all this stuff, and it didn't really pan out that way, did it? What was your prediction?
Well, I just listened back, and I don't think I made a serious prediction, but I was certainly erring on that
coward.
Side. That
coward.
Maybe I was just waiting for you to ask me the question, and it never came, you know?
Yeah, selfish from me, sorry.
We did both make a player of the series prediction. You went with Josh Hazlewood, and I went with Manus Labuschagne. Maybe you can consider yourself a little bit unlucky with your Hoff prediction, mate.
Yeah, I think he was clearly on to be player of the series from what we saw in the first innings at the Gabba. And as you pointed out before we started recording, that the guy who was in, you know, ostensibly for him was Scott Boland, and if he'd played all 5 tests and carried that form, you know, into the first 2 tests, he probably would have been player of the series the way he bowled. So yeah, unfortunate for Hazelwood, but I reckon I'll let myself off the hook for that one. And my bold prediction on Marcus Harris, I mean, I'd said that he would make two centuries in the series. He didn't make one. He did make 76 at the MCG, and I think that was a really tough batting pitch. So I'm going to say that was the equivalent of a century. So I'll say I was half right with my bold prediction.
Right. Well, it was the highest score of the test, wasn't it? And it was a very, well, a short test, 3 days it was over. So, yeah, maybe you can give him that.
Not quite. No, what was your bold prediction?
My bold prediction was that there would be a tied test in the series. And I thought as England started well in their second innings in Hobart that I might be on. But unfortunately, they fell over like a house of cards and the tie was not even close in the end. So I have to keep waiting for that one.
Yeah, bad luck on that one. But yeah, you were right. They did start well.
So let's look at what's next for Australia. Next test series for them is going to be Pakistan in Pakistan starting in early March. But before that, a couple of white ball games scheduled. And I assume these T20s will be gearing up for the T20 World Cup at the end of the year. What are we expecting to see in the T20 side? Are we going to see our World Cup winners back at full strength, or are they going to be tinkering a little bit, do you think, to make sure things are right in Australian conditions?
Yeah, that's a good question. It'll be interesting to see how the schedule shakes out. I know they're kind of looking at it with, I mean, the first game is supposed to be on the 31st, which as I look at the calendar, that's about 2 weeks from now. And there's some talk about New Zealand, just with the quarantine restrictions going back to New Zealand, that they might even come out here for longer than previously anticipated, and there could be more games for them. Yeah, in terms of the T20 team, I think that the fast bowlers are going to need a rest at some point. And I mean, maybe Hazelwood can play everything, given he's, you know, missed. He only played one of the five tests this summer. But I really think they need to look after Stark and Cummins, particularly with the big year they've got coming up, which I know we're going to touch on in a bit. Maybe David Warner as well. Maybe Steve Smith as well. And then you'd think probably apart from that. I mean, it would be interesting with some of the guys who've been in the BBL all summer, how kind of fatigued they are, just from a probably more mental fatigue than physical, because those bubbles are tough. And you really have heard, you know, someone like Glenn Maxwell who's battled COVID and then has come back into a bubble. Like, I think that that might be taxing, but yeah, you'd think those guys would be pretty keen to get back out there. So yeah, I think you'd see the bulk of that squad.
Yeah, and while we heard Ricky Ponting nominate Riley Meredith, he might be another who comes in if the pace bowlers are sort of rested. Even Swepson and Inglis, so he also mentioned, you know, a ride on the cusp. So I think we could see some, you know, fresher faces, but it'll be good to see the World Cup winners, you know, on home soil in a few weeks.
Yeah, and they'll have to really start thinking about whether that World Cup team that won in the UAE is, you know, the bulk of them, do they want them to be playing in Australia later this year? The guys you mentioned, plus maybe someone like Ben McDermott, is he someone you look to get into that team in some kind of role, just given success he's had in the Big Bash? So they're kind of the questions. I guess the other one is whether Matthew Wade is, you know, he had a cracking World Cup. So if they're comfortable with him batting at that 6 and 7 slot, do they stick with him? So off the top of my head, they're kind of the ones that they might look at. But I think it'll be mainly a similar team that they go with.
And so, Lou, Australia's opponents in the just concluded Ashes series, England, they weren't at their best. It wasn't the most competitive series we've ever seen. What's your takeaway? Were Australia just far too good, or were England just really awful?
Australia were great, don't get me wrong, but I think the bigger decisive factor in the series was England being pretty poor. Like, I think it got glossed over a little bit how meek their surrender was on the final day. Like, I mean, from that test, probably Joe Root and Mark Wood are the only ones who can really hold their heads up high. And I just thought that maybe, you know, guys like Wokes and Robinson kind of really threw their wickets away towards the end. I thought that one of them, or just someone in that middle to lower order, could have kind of put their hand up and made the test go into a fourth day. Like, you would have thought there would have been some real drive to you know, just make the Aussies work for something in this series, and they didn't. And it's, you know, that's 2 3-day finishes that we've kind of had. So, when you look at it, I mean, do you think anyone apart from, I mean, Crawley's probably advanced his reputation at the back end of the series. Mark Wood definitely did with how he bowled all series, and particularly in Hobart. Johnny Bairstow is probably another one, but I don't know if there's heaps that advance their reputations apart from those three.
Jack Leach's role was sort of, he was in and then he was out, so he couldn't get any consistency. And it seemed the same a bit for Broad as well. He missed the first and the third tests. And by the time he was actually bowling well, you know, the series was sort of over. So they didn't do themselves any favours with their selection either.
No, it would have been really frustrating for someone like Broad, probably for Wood as well. I mean, the fact that he bowled more overs than any other England bowler for the series, and more than half of them were bowled when the series was dead, what were they thinking by leaving him out in Adelaide? And you've got to commend, even the positives for them have a negative aspect to it. So you look at Joe Root, I think his character throughout this series has been unquestionable. I mean, even just observing him at the end of the Hobart test, he was trying to take socially distanced selfies with the fans and trying to interact with the England supporters who were there. And I just think he's shown so much character to carry himself the way he did. But, you know, tactics-wise, I think he missed when the series was live, the way he bowled Leach in Brisbane had a detrimental effect for him over the rest of the series. Then in Adelaide, he clearly wasn't on the same page as his fast bowlers and basically admitted as much after the game. So you know, there's two kind of series-defining tactical errors. So, and then another one, another positive with a negative kind of connotation to it, was Ollie Robinson, who bowled beautifully in the first bit of the series in particular and really looked like just a test bowler for all conditions. And then he really fell away towards the end of the series, to the point where his own bowling coach was calling him unfit. I mean, so it must have been incredibly, disheartening for a lot of aspects of it for England.
Yeah, certainly. But do you think when the time comes for 2023, the next Ashes series in England, it's going to be a close contest again, isn't it? I mean, it always seems to be over there.
Yeah, I imagine it will be, because they're... England are much stronger in their home conditions, and Australia are much weaker in England. They, competed really well in 2019. Yeah, it will be interesting. I mean, you'd think there's probably more. I'm trying to think about how we felt about the Aussie team in 2017-18 and, you know, whether we were as positive about their chances going, you know, looking to 2019, 2 years away. I feel like there's probably a little bit more to hang your hats on if you're an Aussie supporter. You know, the way Cameron Green's come through in this series and emerged as a genuine test all-rounder, the way Travis Head, who is probably, you know, previous, you know, the fact that he wasn't a lock for this series kind of reflected the fact that he'd struggled in Pakistan on debut, fair enough, because the whole team did. He'd also struggled in England in 2019, also fair enough, and he'd cashed in for his two centuries against Sri Lanka and New Zealand in home conditions against slightly weaker opponent. So now you'd think, you know, he's really ready to take the ball by the horns in Pakistan and Sri Lanka. And fast bowling stocks are really healthy. So you'd think there's a little bit more optimism, I suppose, that Australia could be a real force, home and away.
Now it's from one Ashes series to the next. The Women's Ashes starts in just a few days' time. At the time that we recorded this podcast, Australia versus England, it'll be 3 T20s, a test match, and 3 ODIs to decide the Women's Ashes. Hopefully Australia can do the double this year and secure the men's and the women's. And if you want to follow that along via podcast form as well, the Scoop podcast is your one-stop shop for all Women's Ashes stuff. Hosts LJ and M have definitely got you covered in that regard. Louis, thanks for wrapping up the Ashes with me, and I'll talk to you very, very soon.
No worries, Josh. Speak soon.